Everybody likes a Christmas story. And so this morning, we're going to hear just such a story. Not one I'd expect you've heard very often at Christmas, but a Christmas story nonetheless. Like so many of the stories in the Old Testament, this story was written by a masterful story writer. He keeps his listeners in suspense. He pulls them into the story, causes them to ask questions and to wonder how everything's going to turn out. But what makes the Bible stories so different from so many of the stories that we know is that they have a point, a divinely intended point. Bible stories aren't primarily written to amuse or to entertain, but to teach us something about God and how we should live in light of who He is. And so this morning, turn with me to the book of Ruth. As Mr. Samuelson read the first five verses of this book, I trust your curiosity has already been piqued. What a dark beginning to a book. I purposefully had him leave off just where he did to allow the impact of those first five verses to sink in. The situation just kept getting worse and worse. The book begins on an ominous note, even with the time frame. The story is set in the time when the judges judged. I don't know how much you remember about Old Testament history, but the time of the judges was not a good time for the nation of Israel. The note that repeatedly was struck throughout the book of Judges is that in those days there was no king, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. File that phrase in the back of your mind until the end of this book, because this author is full of surprises. So the book of Judges communicates in its structure a downward spiral of the nation, and it finally ends with civil war, where an entire tribe of the nation is almost completely wiped off. Not a good time. And moreover, the book of Ruth continues by saying that there was a famine in the land, and this famine must have been severe. For one man, Elimelech, took his family across the Jordan River Valley into the land of Moab. One wonders about an Israelite leaving the promised land, but the author just keeps moving the story along. Elimelech's name means, "My God is King," which indeed is a major theme of the book. God is the king. He is in control. But then, the situation gets worse. Elimelech dies. The irony is thick. The man whose God is the king dies. The hearer wonders, what is God doing? But we must wait for the story to unfold. But all hope is not yet lost, for Naomi's two sons take wives and they get married in Moab. They settle down in this foreign land, and they live there for about 10 years. 10 years is quite a long time for them to be living in the land of Moab. One wonders, are they ever going to return to Israel? One wonders, where are the kids? 10 years is so long. In a day like theirs, even more so than in ours, children were central to their life. They were central to society. One needed a son. One needed an heir. But then, the unthinkable happens. Both of the sons die. And they do so before they had any children. The family is on the very brink of extinction. The women are left all alone. And in those days, it would have been very, very difficult to be a widow. The society was very male-centered. It would have been difficult for them to make a living, even. And so that's the setting in which we find our main character. Naomi is an old, childless widow in a foreign land. No children to support her, too old to marry and bear children, and too old to work a trade. And moreover, her very family is on the edge of extinction. A dark cloud is looming large over Naomi. And so verse 6 tells of how Naomi decides to return to Israel. It reads, "Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that Yahweh visited his people in giving them food." Take note of the reason of why she is returning. It's because the Lord, or Yahweh, the covenant God of Israel, has visited his people in giving them food. Here the true main character of the book is introduced. He is Yahweh, and here he acts. When he visits his people, he doesn't just come by for a passing glance. He visits for an extended time period. That the word has the idea of caring for and looking out for. In the rest of the book, he's almost behind the scenes, but here he's in the forefront. There's an act at the beginning of the book here and at the end of the book where he is actively working. But in the rest, he almost appears to be in the background. And these two acts are bookends to the book. They show that everything in between is due to his sovereign hand. We'll see this as we move along. But in the rest of the book, you could almost miss his presence. Yet, the author is very skillful in continuing to bring him along. His name occurs 18 times in this book, and there's 5 other times where the name of God is used. That's more times than Naomi, or Ruth, or Boaz. He indeed is the main character. His name is constantly on the lips of his people. They're constantly attributing what happens in the book to his sovereign hand. They're constantly praising and blessing and praying for one another in his name. And then, almost imperceptibly, as we get to the end of the book, we find that the prayers have been answered. We find that God has been working. That's the point of the book. Yahweh is in control. But the beauty of this book is that he works in everyday circumstances. Most of you know that I've been teaching through the book of Daniel. In Daniel, God does amazing miracles. He delivers from the fiery furnace. He delivers from the lion's den. He thunders down his awesome majesty. He humbles the greatest kings of the earth. Not so in Ruth. In Ruth, he works through humble people. In Ruth, he works primarily through 2 poverty-stricken widows. He works through seemingly insignificant events. No spectacular miracles, no grandiose visions, but he's working just as surely as he is in the book of Daniel. It's a reminder that our God works through everyday circumstances of life. He's working in our circumstances as well. And God even brings about amazing things through humble means. The author cleverly shows this as he walks throughout the book, so we'll watch his sovereign hand at work. So, Yahweh visited his people. He gave to them bread. He ended the famine that began in verse 1, and he set in motion all the events that are to follow. He cares for the events of everyday life. He cares for poor widows. Notice the word return here. It's used 12 times in this chapter. The author's clever repetition of this term return signals the main point of the chapter. Naomi is returning home. It also causes the reader to wonder, will Naomi's return be the turning point in her circumstances? Is everything going to turn around for her? So Naomi and her daughters-in-law head out on the long, dusty road back to Israel. But as they are traveling, the long silence of the book is broken. Naomi speaks. She tells her 2 daughter-in-laws to return back to Moab. Why does she do that? As we'll see, it's because there they have a better chance of finding a husband. There they have a better chance of having a life not filled with pain, as Naomi anticipates her life will be. And so her concern is for these 2 daughter-in-laws. In verse 9 she says, "May Yahweh grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." Naomi knows that they have the best chance of finding a husband back home, and she wants them to have the best chance of being cared for. Notice that Naomi prays for her 2 daughter-in-laws. She looks to God to act on their behalf. She trusts that he is able to do so. She prays that God will deal kindly with them. This is the beautiful Hebrew word hesed that we've looked at before. It means faithfulness. It means loyalty. It means goodness. Yahweh is a faithful God. And because of the faithfulness of these 2 Moabite women, she wishes God to act faithfully in return to them. And she even wishes this upon them in a foreign land. She knows that God is a global God, not just the God of Israel. And she knows that he's able to bless foreigners even beyond the borders of Israel. Once again, a key theme in this book, God blesses those who demonstrate faithfulness. We'll see this as we continue to walk. So in verse 10, these 2 women show their commitment to Naomi. They say, "No, but we will return with you to your people." They love Naomi. They wanted to go back with her to help her. But then Naomi reasons against them. She says, "Why would you go back with me? There's no reason to do that." She argues, "Your emotional bond to me shouldn't cause you to do something stupid. Go back home. That's where you'll find a husband." Her argument here is strong. She shows how unlikely it would be for them to find a husband if they returned with her. Even if she got married that very night, even if she had kids, even if she had twin boys that very night, and would they wait for them to grow up? No, Naomi says. Her life is hard, and there's no reason for them to go with her. It's more bitter for Naomi than for her daughter-in-laws. There's no reason for them to share in her bitterness. They might as well at least go home, where they at least have a chance of finding a husband. Notice how marriage is the central issue at hand. That's what was at stake. And as we'll see, that's the central issue that needs to be resolved in this book. Notice also that Naomi recognizes that it's Yahweh who brought her low. She never doubted that it was his sovereign hand at work. Everything that happened was a result of what he did. So as hard as it was that she was in these extremely difficult circumstances, there's still that ray of hope that if God brought her low, he's able to bring her back up again. And so Orpah, the first daughter-in-law, listened to her mother-in-law, and she kissed her goodbye. As bitter as leaving it was, it would be for the best, she reasoned. But Ruth clung to her. So once again, in verse 15, Naomi tries to reason with Ruth to go home. What will Ruth do? Will she follow after her sister-in-law? Here Ruth is, standing on the edge of decision. Will she go back to the safe? Will she go back to the comfortable? Back to friends and relatives? Or to the unknown? But she stubbornly refuses to go back. She tells Naomi she would not abandon her. Ruth realized that Naomi only told half of the story. For Ruth to go back would not only be to return to Moab, it would be to turn away from Naomi. Here she speaks for the first time in the story, and as one said, her words soar on the wings of rhythm. You know her great response. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may Yahweh do to me, and worse, if anything but death separates you and me. This is total commitment. She will stick with Naomi no matter what. This is great faithfulness to her mother-in-law, despite great risks and dangers. She gave up everything to be loyal. It's not here that Orpah did something wrong. The author says or implies nothing negative about what she did. Orpah did the normal thing. She did the reasonable thing. She even listened to her mother-in-law. But Ruth did the amazing thing. Orpah took the safe route. Ruth took the dangerous route. What extraordinary faith. As one commentator said, one may understand Orpah, one must emulate Ruth. How amazing it is that this foreigner committed her life and her future to Yahweh. Her strong commitment ends with the oath to Yahweh. This shows that she trusted in him and she believed that he is in control. I would even go so far as to say she was converted to Yahweh. She acknowledged that he is the one true God. She even gave up her ethnic and national ties. Quite amazing for that time period. She decided to follow an old widow rather than seeking a husband. So she cast in her lot with Yahweh, whatever the results may be. When Naomi saw that Ruth was strengthening herself to go back with her, she said no more. Ruth was a strong woman. She steeled herself to make this commitment. And so the two of them returned to Bethlehem. And the city was in an uproar at the return of Naomi, who had been gone for so long. They wanted to know what had happened. So Naomi told them. Naomi's words stressed that God had caused her bitterness, her bitter circumstances. He is the one who had brought her back empty. Her suffering is real. One can feel the personality, the real humanity of Naomi. The reader questions, how could Yahweh do this to this poor widow who trusts in him? But Yahweh's ways are mysterious. The fact that he is still in control piques the curiosity and says, what is Yahweh going to do next? And so the chapter ends. Naomi and Ruth return. They have come home. But just as the page is closing on this chapter, the narrator throws in one last bright ray of sunshine, peeking through the clouds. They return just at the beginning of barley harvest. What a coincidence! Harvest time was a joyful time in Israel. It was a time of rejoicing and reaping, singing and scything. And so the chapter ends. It began with famine and ended with harvest. It began with departure and ended with return. Is there hope still on the horizon? Yet there are still problems and questions. How will these two poor widows eat? Will they starve? Will their family line be cut off? What about the concern for a husband and an heir? So chapter 2 begins. The narrator begins with a piece of background information that is necessary for the reader to understand the rest of the chapter, and indeed the rest of the story. It introduces us to Boaz, and he gives us two facts about him. One, that he was a relative of Naomi's, and two, that he was a man of great ability. The word here for ability is significant. It's a key word in this book. It's the word chayil. It denotes ability, capability, and even strength or wealth. This shows that, well, that Boaz was a wealthy, strong, influential man. He's a man of means. So back to the story. Ruth takes the initiative to go gleaning in the fields. This was not easy work. It has been likened to what picking up aluminum cans would be like in our society. It was mere sustenance living. But with no other alternative, she takes the risks to seek to provide and to survive. So she goes out to glean in the fields, and the narrator tells us that she chanced a chance to end up in the field of Boaz. Ruth doesn't know this yet, and neither does Naomi. She just randomly set out to glean in a field, and this is the one that she happened to happen chance to end up in. What a coincidence! She ended up in the very field of the man mentioned in verse 1. Here the author is using a form of striking understatement to make a point. The whole sentence smacks of hyperbole. She chanced a chance? This was no chance. Yahweh was behind it. The point is that Yahweh is sovereign even over the little happen chance occurrences of our daily lives. And so, being in his field, guess who shows up? Behold, it's Boaz. Coincidence upon coincidence. And so as he enters, he pronounces a blessing on his workers in the name of Yahweh, and they do likewise. And so as Boaz comes to check out his field, he notices this young woman gleaning who he doesn't recognize. So he asks the foreman who she is, and the foreman responds that she's the Moabitess that returned with Naomi, and that she's been standing and working hard all day long. She only now has sat down. What faithfulness is demonstrated by Ruth. What a hard worker and a loyal daughter-in-law. So Boaz addresses her directly. How is this rich Israelite going to treat this poor foreign widow? He calls her my daughter. How gentle, how caring. He even protects and provides for her. He has commanded his workers to watch out for her and not to touch her. He even allows her to drink the water that his young men had drawn up. In those times, the foreigners usually drew water for the Israelites. What a turn! Ruth recognizes and then questions for the reason for this graciousness. Why would he take notice of a foreigner? How could he recognize the unrecognizable? Boaz responds, "It is because of what Ruth has done for her mother-in-law. It has not gone unnoticed. She gave up all her past to help this helpless woman. She would not abandon Naomi, but she would abandon her people and her homeland." What a great, great truth. She wouldn't abandon Naomi, but she would abandon her homeland. And so therefore, Boaz prays a prayer and a blessing on her that Yahweh would reward her work, that he would pay her wages in full, upon Yahweh, the God of Israel, in whose wings she has taken refuge. Ruth has cast her whole life upon Yahweh. She has taken refuge in him. And so like a bird that protects its young with its wings, so Yahweh would take care of those who seek refuge in him. And so Boaz prays that God would bless this faithful woman. And so we learn the character of our two main characters in this story. We see that Boaz is a gracious man, just as Ruth is a faithful woman. So as the story unfolds, Boaz even invited Ruth to partake of the lunch meal where his workers were taking of. He went above and beyond in his kindness and care. She had enough to eat, and even then some. And beyond that, he even told his workers to allow Ruth to glean among the sheaves of already harvested barley. And even beyond that, he told his workers to pull up stalks of sheaves and to lay them down for her to pick up after them. What overflowing, abundant kindness. So Ruth worked hard all day long. And when she returned to Naomi, Naomi immediately noticed the immense amount that she had gleaned. She took home almost 30 pounds of barley. Indeed, Yahweh had begun to pay her back for her faithfulness, but not completely yet. And so, Naomi invokes a blessing on the one who took notice of her. She could not have gleaned this much from the normal gleaning process. Someone had to be responsible. So Naomi asks, "Who took notice of you?" As Ruth responds, the narrator cleverly leaves the name of the individual till the very end of the sentence. He builds up suspense as Naomi is waiting to find out what the reader already knows, namely, that it was Boaz. Upon hearing who this kind man was, Naomi once again invokes a blessing upon him. He has not abandoned his faithfulness and loyal love. Have you noticed how many times in this book already there have been prayers for blessing? It's a subtle hint throughout the book that God is working. And so Naomi proceeds to tell Ruth that Boaz is one of their near relatives, one of their kinsmen redeemers, in fact. A kinsman redeemer was a near relative who had the obligation of caring for his family members and the unfortunate members of his extended family. All the specifics aren't yet known, but they'll be revealed as the story continues on. So as this chapter comes to a close, things have started to turn around for Naomi and Ruth. Yahweh's gracious provision of food has fended off starvation, at least for the immediate future. And so, as the two widows sit at home, the question is, what's next? Ruth took great risks. She was very bold. She opened up a lot of opportunities, but what will come of them? The story is somewhat on pause. The food problem has been resolved, but there are still so many threads that yet need to be tied up. And so, as the next chapter opens up, Naomi has a plan. She has been considering the circumstances and is still concerned about finding a husband for Ruth. So verse 1 clearly says that Naomi was concerned with finding security, or literally rest, for Ruth. This was clearly the fact that Naomi wanted to find a husband for Ruth and the peace, security, and belonging that it would provide for her. Interestingly, that's the very thing that she prayed for Ruth in chapter 1. But she wasn't content to just sit passively and wait. She decided to act. She believed in God's sovereignty, but that never became an excuse for inaction. Naomi's plan is filled with mystery. Ruth is to get all dressed up, to anoint herself, and to go to the threshing floor under the cover of darkness. The threshing floor was a place known for immorality. Moreover, Ruth is to spy on Boaz until he is satisfied and content, and after he is done eating and drinking and gone to bed, she's to go and uncover his feet and lie down. Certainly, Naomi trusts Boaz and Ruth, but this is still quite a plan. Every little detail has been thought out by her to provide this situation exactly what she's looking for. This is Naomi's clever, calculated plan. And so her faithful daughter-in-law Ruth is obedient to everything. In secrecy, she does what she is told. And so, at the end of verse 7, Ruth is lying at the man's feet in the middle of the night. The audience is left to question the morality of what happens. Is this okay? The author only heightens the suspicion with his choice of words. The decisive moment is at hand. What is going to happen? And so, in the middle of the night, Boaz is startled, and behold, there's a woman at his feet. Quite a shocker, don't you think? Here, this Israelite who's upright, he wakes up, and he finds himself in a secluded corner of the threshing floor with a woman lying there in the middle of the night. And so he questions, "Who are you?" Ruth responds, "I am Ruth, your maid. Spread your covering over your maid, for you are a kinsman redeemer." What a packed statement. There's a key play on words going on here. The word for covering is the same word used for wing in chapter 2. She is asking Boaz for protection, just as a bird protects its young with its wings. Thus Ruth is asking Boaz to answer his own prayer. It was Boaz who prayed in chapter 2 that Ruth would be taken of by Yahweh, who, since she took refuge under his wings. Once again, Yahweh is not acting directly, but through the acts of his righteous people. God works through ordinary means. He works through people who are faithful to him and faithful to doing his will. Furthermore, what she asks here was an idiom for marriage. She's asking Boaz to marry her. And her reasoning is because Boaz was a kinsman redeemer. This was one of the duties and responsibilities for the poor that God had given to a kinsman redeemer, to his family members. What would Boaz say to that? He responds by pronouncing a blessing upon her from Yahweh. He says, "May you be blessed of Yahweh, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than your first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich." Boaz recognized that Ruth was not doing this for her own sake, but for her family, for her mother-in-law, for Naomi's sake. This faithfulness was even greater than her first faithfulness of abandoning her family, abandoning her homeland, and caring for her mother-in-law. Once again, it's the same word, hesed. She was willing to marry an older man because he was in their clan and had responsibilities to care for the family. What loyalty! She didn't make this decision based on greed or based on passion, but based on loyalty for her family. What a selfless, loyal woman. So Boaz tells Ruth in verse 11 not to fear. He will do what she asked. And why? Because of her reputation. She was known by all as being a woman of excellence. That's not the best translation for this word. It's our key word, chayo, from earlier. It means that she's able, competent, capable, and strong. She's a hard worker. That was proved in the fields. And as we see throughout the book, she has depth of character. It's actually the same key word describing the Proverbs 31 woman in Proverbs 31. A capable, competent, strong wife who can find. Read Proverbs 31. That woman was competent. That woman was strong. Her strength lay in her character. She was trustworthy. She was industrious. She was astute. She was efficient. She made her husband look good. That's the kind of woman that Ruth was. Ruth was a good match for Boaz because, as we saw earlier, Boaz himself was chayo. But just as it seems the story is going to come to an end, there's going to be immediate resolution, there's a plot twist. There's a redeemer who's even closer than Boaz. And what's worse, he has first right of redemption. And so Boaz, because he's an upright man, is going to do everything uprightly. Boaz says, if he's going to redeem you, good. The important thing, Boaz reasons, is that you are cared for. Maybe that's why Boaz hasn't done anything up to this point in the story in the first place. It's because he didn't have the right to. And so Boaz swears with an oath that he will carry this out. Now, nighttime was no kind of time for a woman to be out and about, so they spent the night at the threshing floor. What's interesting, the author uses a different word here for spending the night so that it's very, very clear that there's no impropriety in their actions. The earlier innuendo is gone. They did what was upright, without question. And so, not only protecting Ruth physically, Boaz also protects her reputation. And in the morning, he sends her away with food, about 80 pounds worth. Once again, Boaz shows his generosity. And so as Ruth returns, Naomi is anxiously waiting to find out how her plan went. Ruth explains the barley by telling Naomi that Boaz didn't want her to return empty. Thus, the reader is reminded of Naomi's earlier emptiness from chapter 1. Maybe resolution is coming soon. Maybe the emptiness will be filled. This time, Naomi tells Ruth to wait and see how things will turn out. There's a time to act, and there's a time to wait. Boaz was a man of his word, and he would surely keep it. He won't rest until the matter is completed. The end is at hand. So now there's nothing that they could do, and so they must just wait around and see what would happen. And so they're waiting to see how the matter falls out. This was an idiom that was used for casting of lots. The results were up to Yahweh. And so as chapter 3 ends, the tension was raised a notch. Will the unnamed redeemer get the girl? Furthermore, in this chapter, there's been an emphasis on the human action, almost opposed to the divine. But in the context of the book, it's a reminder that God works through human agents, specifically through those who trust in him and believe in him and seize the opportunities given by him. So as night turns to day, the last chapter of the book is opened, not at a secretive threshing floor, but this time at a public gate. So right away, Boaz sets about his business. He goes to the city gate, which was bustling with people, and the place where public transactions took place. And behold, what do you know? So-and-so, the unnamed redeemer, comes walking along. And so Boaz sets him aside, and he gathers a group of elders to be witnesses to make this meeting official. So Boaz tells so-and-so the situation. Naomi is selling the land that... Wait, what? Naomi? I thought this was all about Ruth. I thought this was about getting married to Ruth. What in the world is Boaz doing here? Boaz understood that redeeming Ruth and buying Naomi's land went hand in hand. The one who redeemed the land would get the girl as well. So Boaz starts with the land aspect of the transaction, and he tells the situation to so-and-so. This sounds like a pretty good deal to so-and-so. He would get Naomi's land, and since Naomi didn't have any children, and since she was too old to have any children, there would be no one who would be able to inherit the land one day. This is a pretty sweet deal. All profit, no risk. And so, of course, so-and-so jumps at the opportunity. I will redeem it, he says. What a letdown. So-and-so gets the girl? What about good old Boaz? But just when it seems that the story will end on a good but not so exciting note, Boaz steps in. He has cleverly left till last an important part of the transaction. On the day that you buy Naomi's land, you also have to take Ruth the Moabitess as your wife. All of a sudden, the transaction changes. Ruth is young. She could have children. She could have lots of children. And this redeemer would have to divide up his inheritance with her children as well as his. He would have to divide it all up. And not only that, he'd have to care for Ruth and Naomi. No, he says, I can't redeem it. This would ruin my inheritance. So-and-so is unable to redeem. Kind of one lends you to suspect, has Boaz been somewhat of a sly guy here? Has he outwitted old so-and-so? He got both the ground and the girl, and you wonder if he waited till just the right moment to add complications to the deal. But even more importantly than that, it shows Boaz's generosity in redeeming Naomi's land and Ruth. He was willing to take the risks. He was willing to take the dangers of to his own inheritance that so-and-so wasn't able to. It's not like so-and-so did something wrong. Like Orpah, he did what was expected. He did what was normal. But Boaz went the extra mile. He showed extreme faith. Adding suspense to the moment, the author gives us a side note about how transactions were completed in those days. A man took off his sandal and gave it to the other man. This sort of gives you suspense as you're waiting for the key part in the story. And it also serves to reinforce that what was happening was legal. Everything was done rightly and in order. And so-and-so gave his sandal to Boaz to confirm the deal. The right to redeem the land and Ruth was transferred. And so Boaz called all the people present, including 10 of the elders who were to be witnesses of the transaction. Boaz bought Naomi's land and redeemed all that belonged to Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion. But even beyond all of that, Boaz acquired Ruth as his wife. No longer a foreigner in a foreign land, Ruth would be an Israelite. No longer a widow, Ruth would be a wife. Boaz would take Ruth to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. The family line was thus spared. And thus the narrator is giving us a hint of what may be coming. But earlier, Ruth hadn't had children for 10 years. Would she be able to now? And so the transaction is completed. The crowd says, "We are witnesses. It is complete. It is sure. The reader can rest easy." And so they follow with a blessing that they wished upon the new couple. Read their poetic blessing in verse 11. "May Yahweh make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, both of whom built the house of Israel. And may you achieve wealth in Ephrathah and become famous in Bethlehem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah, through the offspring which Yahweh will give you by this young woman." Quite a prayer for blessing. This is large. "May Yahweh make your wife like the two founding mothers of Israel. May your house be like the house of Israel." The term house was a term akin to the term for dynasty. This is obviously larger than just an heir for Elimelech. It's hinting that possibly something larger is at hand. They continue, may you achieve wealth. But once again, this is our word chayil. This is larger than just wealth. May you do great and able things. They continue, may your name be great. It means may your fame and reputation be great. And lastly, may your house be like Perez. May your family line become significant. Quite a great blessing for this couple. All in the name of Yahweh, who has the power to bring it about. These prayers anticipate the great things that Yahweh is going to do. This extraordinary blessing was fitting on these two who had demonstrated extraordinary faith in Yahweh. They took great risks for him. And so in the next verse, Boaz married Ruth and took her as his wife, and Yahweh acted once again. His sovereign action, like we said, bookends this book. This time, he gave Ruth conception. Yahweh indeed is at work. In light of 10 years earlier of no children, this is obviously from his sovereign hand. So the author quickly moves the story along, and 9 months pass quickly. And at the end, a son is born. Finally an heir. Finally resolution to all the loose ends. The family line will not be extinguished. Yahweh is at work. Yahweh had paid Ruth back in full, even as Boaz prayed that he would. Yahweh indeed does reward faithfulness. And so, as in chapter 1, Naomi ends in the spotlight. The neighborhood woman who welcomed Naomi's sad return now greet the son's happy birth. And they give all the credit to Yahweh. They say, "Blessed be Yahweh. He is the one that deserves the praise. He is the one that deserves the credit for today's events. He is responsible for them all. He has not left you without a kinsman redeemer today." Notice that Yahweh acted by what he prevented. Here, it wasn't a single event that Yahweh did that brought this about. He had to act all along the way to prevent this from happening. He had to work through the whole entire story to prevent Naomi from being redeemerless. And so, you see Yahweh works through everyday circumstances of life. The widow's return, the chance meeting, the successful plan, the day in court, the conception, they all came from him. They finish their blessing by asking that he be a restorer of Naomi's life and a sustainer of her old age, because her daughter-in-law, who loves her and is better to her than 7 sons, has borne a son to him. Ruth loved Naomi to the utmost. She risked her life and her future to provide for her. And as a result, Naomi was to be cared for by this Redeemer, even better than seven sons could care for her. And so Naomi took the child and became his nurse. What a tender picture to end the story on, to return the joy that was lost, a son to replace the two that had died. And so the neighborhood women, in excitement, cry out that Naomi at last has a son. And they name him Obed, and he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. A final surprise, this child was the grandfather of King David. And so in a time that there was no king in Israel, God sovereignly provided for his king to come. Suddenly, this story was brought from the past to the present of the readers. An exclamation point is added to the whole book. As one said, suddenly this simple, clever human story of two struggling widows takes on a startling new dimension. It becomes a bright, radiant thread woven into the fabric of Israel's larger national history. All of the amazing statements and prayers made earlier are suddenly immediately seen not to be exaggerations at all. Boaz and Ruth indeed found a ruling dynasty, from a Moabite immigrant, no less. Yahweh's sovereign control also takes on new meaning at this point. By his overarching sovereignty, Yahweh caused these two poor widows to change the nation, and indeed to change the world. The bitter question raised at the beginning of whether or not God was king is now answered. God is the king. How generous is Yahweh to those who take refuge in his wings. Everything has been reversed. Bitterness was turned to joy, doubt to certainty, uneasiness to security. The women who welcomed Naomi's sad return now greet the son's happy birth. The empty one was made full. Two dead children are replaced by a new child. The near extinction of a family line averted. A foreigner becomes an Israelite. And prayers are answered. Naomi's prayer for rest and a husband for Ruth answered. Boaz's prayer that God would pay back Ruth for her work answered. And the people's prayers at the gate that God would make their house great answered. Ultimately, God uses this to bring about the dynasty through whom his king would come. And so, the author ends with a genealogy. How fitting that Perez is at the top of the list. Indeed, Boaz's house has become as great as his ancestors. And so, a link is made between Boaz, the hero of our story, and Boaz, the ancestor of David. They're one and the same man. And Boaz receives almost heroic status for his rescuing of a faltering family line. And so you ask, what does this have to do with Christmas? This has everything to do with Christmas. For through this poor, lowly widow, God sovereignly brought about King David, through whom the Messiah, the true and final king, would come. And so, turn to another genealogy, this time in Matthew chapter 1. You know the genealogy. Matthew chapter 1 begins, "The record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Jesus was the son of David. That is the emphasis. Notice even in verse 5, Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab, Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse. Here are our characters, Boaz, Obed, and Ruth, all in the line of the Messiah. And the genealogy ends in verse 17. "So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. Here Matthew's concern is to show that Jesus was the son of David. Five times his name is mentioned in this list. He is at the center of it all. For it is the Davidic covenant that states that a king will descend from David, whom God will establish as king forever, and through whom his kingdom will not come to an end. And this is Jesus Christ, King of the Jews, whose birth we celebrate." Last week, we had the great privilege of hearing Doug preach through Romans chapter 1, and we saw that long ago, God had an eternal plan promised beforehand in the scriptures concerning his son. The birth of Christ was no last-minute plan. He orchestrated all of history so that his son would be born a descendant of David according to the flesh, the heir to the Davidic throne, and the fulfillment of the promise that his kingdom would be forever, sometimes through massive miracles, sometimes through poor widows. And so this Christmas, we celebrate the amazing plan of God. He works even through the happen-chance occurrences of our daily lives to bring about his grand purpose. He even works through the poor and the lowly. We never know what God is going to do through us. God is active, sometimes behind the scenes, sometimes in the foreground, but working nonetheless. This book also gives us a glimpse into the heart of God. He cares for the poor. He cares for the lowly. He cares for those who take refuge in his wings. He cares for foreigners. And ultimately, as we think about this simple little story, we realize that the happen chance ending up in a particular field was what God used to bring about the Savior of the world, the King, the Lord Jesus Christ. The God who cares for the lowly, who is concerned for foreigners, brought his Son in the world that the world may be saved through him. God indeed cares for Gentile foreigners, for he has saved us. So how do we respond? We follow the example of Ruth and Boaz, living lives of risky faith, risking all because our futures and our lives depend on him. Because we realize that God works through faithful people, we live lives of hesed, of faithful loyalty. We live lives pursuing righteous living, not passively sitting in a corner. God's sovereignty is never an excuse for inaction. Yet there is a time to wait as well as to act. So as we wait for him to work, we trust God for the results. We never know how things will fall out. And as we live lives of trust in God, we recognize that God works in mysterious ways. We trust and we wait on him, for the dark cloud of bitterness that is looming large over us and seems to be following us around, turning bad to worse, may indeed rain blessings on our head. And so this Christmas season, may we also respond with thankfulness and gratitude for the plan of God. May awe, wonder, and worship flow forth from us as we consider the birth of the King. Let's close in prayer. Our Father, as we do consider this simple story, we realize that it teaches us so much of who you are, an awesome God, a powerful God, a God who works, even through our daily occurrences and even through simple events. We pray that you would help us to live risky faith, living lives of trust in you, dependence on you always, because we know that you're in control. And as we consider the birth of the King, we consider your awesome plan about how you brought your Son, the King, from such lowly means. We stand in awe and wonder and worship at who you are. May we live lives of thankfulness and gratitude as we consider all that you have done for us in redeeming poor foreigners. And we praise you in Christ's name. Amen.